One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to Censored. I'm Dr. Lloyd Maeve Houston.
And I'm Dr. Aoife Vrytnach.
And this week we are saddling up and riding off bleakly into the sunset, contemplating the ways in which modern times like these have no place for the likes of us, with 1969's The Wild Bunch, directed by Sam Peckinpah.
Yes, we're going Western for the first time, in spite of the hundreds, thousands of Western movies made. This is one of the few kind of controversial ones that came before the Irish censor, because the Western tended to be, I wouldn't say it's vanilla, but it tended to be a genre that was less problematic for the Irish censor than, nearly any other genre, really.
Yeah, I suppose because of its ubiquity and because it's such a durable template with, in its earlier iterations at least, a very clear moral framework. It's interesting that it's only really when you get to the stage of the revisionist or anti-Western, of which this is a kind of archetypal example, that eyebrows begin to get raised. So you can have big old bar brawls and shootouts and massacre indigenous people to your heart's content. But once you start wrestling with what happens if you actually have a massive shootout in a populated civilian area, then suddenly things begin to become a little troubling for the Irish censor.
It was a funny one because, in many ways, when you talk about the genre of the Western, to describe the plot, which we're going to try and do at the very beginning for a change. So the plot is, group of men arrive in town, hold up a bank, steal loads of bags of money, run away and are chased by another group of men who are trying to track them down. And that's the basic template, which is a very Western template.
And I guess that's part of the sort of revisionism, is that, like, structurally it's got all your sort of hallmark set pieces or story structure beats. It's just how they're executed. But yeah, so we've got our titular Wild Bunch, who are a sort of gang of wrong'uns but bound by a code, sort of
code of honor,
and they are being pursued by a group of bounty hunters employed by a railway that they have hit several times, and that posse is headed up by a former member of their gang who was wounded and imprisoned, and who is grappling with the complex ethics of hunting men he loves and violating his own code to do so. But then I guess where things do get more complicated, or like historically sort of pointed, is that it then all spills over into revolutionary Mexico. And so because this score goes wrong, like, they've been set up, the Wild Bunch get roped in to do a raid on an arms shipment to steal weapons for this comically nasty Generalissimo, who's part of the faction that had come to power by a sort of American-backed coup, if I'm remembering my history right. But basically, like, nasty piece of shit.
That's the most important part of his character. And also the Germans are somehow on his side, which clearly very bad.
Yeah, receiving military consultancy from the Germans, who are not, who obviously aren't Nazis, but Peckinpah isn't not leaning in on the, like, but Germans are pretty, they're pretty sus though, aren't they? Especially if they're in kind of military uniform and being very technocratic about weaponry. So the one of the Wild Bunch, Angel, is an indigenous person from a community who are under the jackboot of this regime and who want to resist. and want arms to do that. They give arms to this group from this shipment. They keep back one box. That is revealed. Angel gets ratted out. He's taken captive by the general and dragged behind his car in a really horrible dry land keel hauling. And eventually, the Wild Bunch are so disgusted by this and so just like burnt out on this life and kind of in that weird, you know, almost kind of meta way, like they recognize that it's near the end of the movie and near the end of their sort of time in the world. They go back to take him by force and precipitate, like they basically, they gun down the general who cuts Angel's throat, right? Everyone's so startled that they could probably just walk away. But then instead they're like...
That was amazing, that part.
An incredible moment. Yeah, where you sort of see them and, you know, Ernest Borgnine's character is kind of laughing at the like, oh, okay, apparently we're going to get away with this. And then Pike, the like leader, is like, nah, I'm going to shoot that German. Like, I want to die. I'm ready to like kill everyone. And it precipitates what is, yeah, one of the most absurdly nihilistic, willfully futile, but gloriously executed gunfights, like total bloodbath.
Absolutely.
And then it closes with the former gang member who'd been hunting them, but who walked away from their pursuit once they had been gunned down. He just sits down and waits. And sorry, this is way too much plot. I'm sorry, I'm really fucking this.
No, this is good because we're going to discuss this in the cuts.
Okay, so cool. Yeah. So he sits down and waits as the ramshackle, nasty, really avaricious posse that he's been leading, as they go off with the bodies to claim the bounty. And they are then heavily implied to be picked off very quickly by the indigenous villagers and another member of the gang who's been wounded. And they invite him to join the revolution, basically. So there is this kind of interesting moment of like, okay, the values that you stood for as like a Western frontiersman, you know, there's no place for them in modernity, except in the vanguard of a revolution on behalf of the oppressed, which is a pretty kind of, you know, it's an interesting note for it to strike, I guess. But yeah, sorry, that's the overly elaborate plot summary. As Aoife says, in some ways, it's a very simple archetypal plot, but there is sort of interesting texture to how it wants to tease out the moral greyness of all this. And the moral exhaustion of a lot of the parties involved.
Yeah, it's really about like aging people as well as being caught out by modernity. These are old men who have been doing this job, this being on the trail, raiding, whoring, carrying on,
so
basically.
So much whoring. So, I know parts of it are meant to land as distasteful, but God, this film really likes mistreating women.
I mean, it's the default position. When the men are cross with each other, they can bond by being mean and horrible about women verbally and in the moment. I mean, it's like, we have a problem between men. Let's shit on a woman. Yeah. Yay.
But sex workers, you know, at least we have that. And it's like, great, cool. Also, but yeah, again, in ways that the film is a bit more cognizant of, put them in the line of fire and they just grab a nearby woman as a kind of human shield. And as a sort of contemporary viewer, I was still like, oh, Jesus. Okay, yeah, that's not something the like, quote unquote, you know, anti-heroes of this sort of film tend to do.
Yeah, I mean, they are not particularly heroic. Like, it seems, like I say, like the normal setup, but there is that piece where the Wild Bunch are arriving in the town and they pass the kids torturing the scorpions, where you're like, oh yeah, this is gonna be, yeah, okay, this is a hint about what is about to happen.
That the opening of this film particularly, I think, is really astonishing. Like, I feel like what we said off mic, maybe we have slightly different levels of excitement about this, but I do think that opening, like intercutting between them arriving, you know, they've disguised themselves as soldiers in the US Army. So they're, you know, saluting, they're looking as respectable as humanly possible. You know, they help an old lady cross the street and stuff. But it's all intercut with a bunch of kids. And the way this film uses cutting to children at all sorts of different points, I find fascinating. But
yeah, that was really interesting. I agree.
And children as like viewers and spectators to this, like it's, if we're talking about this as kind of a film about aging, it's about a genre aging as well, right? Like this is the late style of the Western. And like Peckinpah, as someone who grew up on, you know, a previous generation of Westerns, like the questions of like what it does to watch these sorts of stories play out and what kind of person that makes you is really interestingly done just through these often narratively needless intercuts to children as spectators of violence. But you've got a bunch of kids who are all sort of like huddled together doing something. And initially you're sort of like, oh, you know, it'll be some sweet, innocent thing. Like they're playing with a spinning top. And then it's like, no, they've built like a kind of fucking like gladiatorial arena in which two scorpions are being attacked by hundreds of fire ants. And they're like just poking them with sticks to keep the scorpions in. And then just as the scorpions are giving up the ghost and being completely overwhelmed, they then cover it with like brush and set it on fire. It's like the most just like nihilistic, like, oh yeah, there is something rotten in the heart of man, and yeah, our capacity to spectacularize violence and find fascination in suffering is, it's like Jesus Christ, Sam, like
it's so much for innocent children, you know. It's like, you think there is something called a state of innocence? Really? Are you sure about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, or and obviously that kind of is, it's finally paid off when Pike, the anti-hero among anti-heroes, or, you know, a sort of troubled moral center to this thing, the last man of the Old West, is gunned down by a child in uniform.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just like, Jesus.
Well, speaking of children, one of the odder cuts that was implemented, you're really not going to believe this as a cut. It's very strange. So it came before a deputy censor called Gabriel Fallon, and he wanted to ban it completely. And one of the things he really didn't like was towards the end of the film, when they're in the general's compound, they go to see two women who are sex workers. So, you know, you could call it a brothel, but it's, you know, it's their gaff, like it's their house. So there's, you know, Pike is in the room with the woman and she's washing and there's a baby in the corner.
Mm.
And the baby starts crying. Do you remember that? And then next door, the other two lads are having an argument with another woman. And apparently the baby crying to heighten the dramatic tension was really, really offensive to Gabriel Fallon.
What?
I'm just like, I don't really know what he means, other than the fact maybe he thinks that women with children cannot be sex workers.
I feel like there's some, you know, there are sex workers and there are mothers and ne'er the twain, you know, in that enshrined in the Constitution sort of way, right? Not to be too topical.
Oh, yeah, it probably is. Don't get me started. Actually, that's my plan for the Patreon extra, is the Constitution.
And yeah. Now Aoife will go off on one about the referenda results.
No, I won't talk about that, but I will go off in one, yes.
But yeah, that opening sequence thesis statement about the way that violence is spectacularized, or the inherent cruelty, that the absence of innocence, the way that that's intercut with, you know, us following these figures who we assume are like goodies, or at least sort of white hat kind of cowboys. Probably worth pointing out, it's set in 1913, so it's also, you know, it's at the literal end of this, you know, the kind of advent of modernity as we would understand it is rolling out along the frontier or whatever. But yeah, they go into this railway office and you think that they're on the level, and then you see that there are people lying in wait to kind of ambush them, and you assume that they're the villains almost. And then the credits, which they've been doing the sort of like, you know, starring, etc., you know, and every time they kind of introduce a new name, it'll sort of freeze frame. And the final one is Pike, or like, you know, again, protagonist-ish, and played by William Holden, so a figure who's already been in a previous generation of Westerns and, you know, whom we're being primed to perceive a certain way. They just immediately round on everyone, and he's like, if they move, kill them. And then it's just directed by Samuel Peckinpah, and it's like... Fair play. That's how you start a movie.
I thought it was interesting how it was very much bookended by those two pieces of spectacular violence. Mm. The opening raid and then the fight in the compound. So a lot of the bits in the middle, I mean, they're very good. They're beautifully shot. I mean, it's very well acted. It's lovely to look at. It's like the landscape is beautiful. And it did feel very much to me like a very familiar Western in those parts where you're like, This is very much the rhythm of what I am used to. But the opening and the closing are where it really complicates what you might think is happening then in the middle, where you're like, like all of this wandering around and beautiful landscapes and nice horses and intrepid adventures. Like, but we started off with a bank raid in which half the town appears to have been killed.
Yeah, there's a temperance union parade that moves through the middle of it. And yeah, it turns out that the people lying in wait for the ambush are like this posse of bounty hunters employed by the railroad. And yeah, once they've been clocked, the people we've been structurally primed to regard as the heroes immediately just throw out this elderly man who's like the telegraph operator or whatever, like runs the sort of railroad office. So he just gets gunned down, and it then initiates, this absolute bloodbath in which you have like RoboCop level squibs going off. Like everything is squibbed, everyone is squibbed. And even though it's that very 1960s, you know, scarlet red paint blood, like bloody violence in which just like women, you know, elderly women, some possibly even, I think some children are implied to be sort of hit. Like it's, you have a hell of a lot of civilians getting gunned down or being grabbed as cover. You've got one member of the gang who's just been told, like he's just been left to kind of be there, like...
I think they forgot about him, no?
Pike at least knows what he's doing and sort of being like, you stay here, keep a gun on these people and like cover our exit. And he's just a complete psychopath. Like he's, you know, licking a woman's face and making them all sing. And it's like, okay, these guys are not on the level.
And he is the most good-looking, youngest individual of the whole group. Mm. Like he is the one that, in the cinema, you normally have like the clean-cut looking hero. He could indeed look like a clean-cut hero, except that he is so bad. He is rotten to the core.
Whenever they eventually, like the people he's holding hostage run out, he just guns them down and cackles about it, is then himself shot. And then as he's sort of, you know, lying panting on the ground, he sees an opportunity to just shoot some more people, so does. It's like, Jesus, this guy is... I mean, in terms of the way this is rendered, one of the things I think that sort of cinematically accentuates the intensity of the violence is... what I think for the time was a pretty novel deployment of like intercutting between like quick cuts into slow motion and between different sort of parallel moments of action. So you've got like someone will be shot and fall from a roof and they'll be falling in slow motion, intercut with the person who shot them galloping away and themselves being shot, but in kind of normal tempo. And it's really sort of disorienting, but like it sort of dilates certain moments to just really accentuate the visceral quality of the harm being done. And yeah, you're right, you could be forgiven in the sort of middle of the movie where it settles down into something a bit more conventional, marked by flashbacks to when they were on the road together, or they have a heist that goes pretty well and reminds you that like, oh yeah, these guys must have been great in their day or something. But it's bookended by these just utterly nihilistic massacres, needless violence, not so much in the sense that, like, I'm sure the censor objected to it as, you know, gratuitous, but just like it gives you a sense of this as being a world in which life is insanely cheap.
Well, you're right. I mean, the censorship appeals board absolutely objected to it because they disagreed with Gabriel Fallon and said, no, it should be released, but we should cut bits. And when we talk about the two theatrical violence extravaganzas, beginning and end, yeah, they pretty much hacked the life out of those two parts. So the first part, which, like so many civilians, it's very clever the way it shows the chaos of something like this, right? It's all, of course, completely staged, but it doesn't feel as staged as normal Westerns do, where, you know, people fall off the rooftops and they go, ah, and, you know, all of those typical moments. It has those, but twisted. And of course, this temperance band walking down the road, which just seems huge amounts of women, are just spinning round with blood gouting out of everywhere. So they caught a lot of the civilians dying. And the particular one that I really do remember is there's a woman gets caught under the legs of a horse when they're escaping.
Yeah.
Yeah. They cut that.
Like, way to take the film and make it a standard Western by, like, omitting all that. Like, it's, exactly. it isn't about anything if you get rid of that.
Yes. So what they did really by taking that interesting examination of violence and chaos and perhaps not very nice people with guns and the complicated relationship with the law, all of that, who's right to shoot people, who's wrong to shoot people, you just take it all away and you just make it sort of not even goodies and baddies. It's still not, but
yeah,
it just ruins the depth of the film. Like,
if you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Makes it very superficial.
Well, I mean, because obviously a kind of necessary context for this is that it's a Vietnam movie to some extent, right? Like, in terms of when it's, you know, it's 1969 and you're deep enough into the felt futility of that conflict and the scenes of increasing state violence that was precipitating in America in reaction to protests about it and so on, the scenes of people in uniform firing on crowds of civilians are about more than even just this sort of meta commentary on what the Western as a genre fetishizes, or, you know, leverages that kind of, this is the foundation myth of the sort of, you know, white supremacist American state in its manifest destiny. And especially with, you know, propping up this crackpot dictatorship regime, you know, that resonates with American foreign policy in all sorts of ways. You know, there is on the one hand, it is this sort of recontextualization of violence in cinema and sort of saying, like, no, violence should be consequential, right? Like, if someone gets shot, you should, as an audience, you should feel that. That shouldn't just be... Mm. Like, it's paradoxical because it shows such an exorbitance of violence that it almost exposes the futility of violence, even as it makes you think, like, oh, God, no, yeah, this is... It's not cool to have lots of people riding around shooting at each other. But at the same time, those scenes are not merely about that spectacle. And yeah, so it's hard to imagine what sort of beast this would be absent a lot of that.
Well, as Kevin Rockett points out, you know, it radically affects the rhythm of the film if you do this.
Mm.
You know, it does really make it into something I'm sure that Sam Peckinpah didn't intend to make, which is just a straightforward Western with lads, you know, good old boys sort of. Also, of course, the censor didn't like any of the references to whoring and all of that horrible toxic conversation that the men have quite a lot. A lot of that is cut. So,
yeah.
The nastier underbelly of these men's personalities and the level to which you say, like, how much of this hero is dark.
Mm.
Like, there's a lot of darkness in those conversations. So they took those out. So if William Holden is already known as a classic Western actor, the audiences are like, oh, here he is doing his Western thing. Yay.
Yeah. Oh, great. Glad he's still working. Yeah.
Yes. It's like we've seen him before in the hat with the guns on the horse. Fabulous. So yeah, I think it's like the level of intervention was really very severe, you know?
Mm. And again, like in an Irish context, it's telling that in ways that Peckinpah probably didn't intend, scenes of a highly militarized society engaging in violence against a civilian populace has a whole, you know, seriously grappling with that those sorts of issues in an Irish setting, both in terms of, you know, 1969 or even the sort of history of, you know, the Civil War and the War of Independence. You know, like there are a lot of moments in contemporary and at that time recent Irish history that it feels like would dispose an Irish audience to take seriously a film like this, or would render morally naive and suspect a film that's just like, ah, sure, this is grand.
Yeah, and of course, at that point, like it comes before the Irish censors in 1970. So at that point, Westerns, although they've been around for a long time, as a genre, it has become, like you said, exhausted. So for a new Western to appear, it must have been very strange to watch it and be like, oh, so it's the same. Like, we've been looking at these types of films for, you know, 40 years now, and we're still in the same place. And it's such a loss to the Irish audience, because not only the opening was cut, but the end in the general's compound, you know, that amazing fight where it's precipitated by the general cutting Angel's throat. Angel's throat was not cut for the Irish audiences. They never saw it.
What?
I love your reaction. It's just great.
But it's like, so, because at that point, it just looks like they gun him down for like doing what they want, right? He's like going to hand over Angel to them, and like, because we've already had in another of the films sort of self-interrogative spectacles of sadistic violence. We've watched him being dragged behind a car, and he's horribly.
Oh, that was cut as well, by the way. Just
sorry, I've hit my microphone. What is this? Like, just don't show it, Ireland. Like, if you're gonna come on, yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean, it just, they made a nonsense of the depth of the work.
It just isn't a final act, though. It's like, okay, so for literally no reason, they go back and
kill
start
everybody.
Killing everyone. But in a way that you probably also don't see. Because, I mean, yeah, it is really hard to sort of communicate. Like, it's a very well, you know, from a technical level, it's a very well-constructed set piece. Among the weapons that they capture is a machine gun set up on the patio where the general and his mates are all getting hammered and being hideous. And so the whole set piece becomes a lot of like different people vying for control of the machine gun. And then just, you know, Peckinpah lovingly, or not lovingly, but like, you know, vividly sort of dramatizing it as the machine gun just rips through crowds of people, culminating in Pike, our exemplar of the Old West, gripping the machine gun, right? This emblem of a modern, mechanized, systematized violence. There's a very telling shot where the guy who's been hunting him takes his six shooter and it's juxtaposed with him sort of clinging limply to the machine gun.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we're on the cusp of a kind of systematized, modern, like technocratic violence that is different from the raw justice of the Old West. I mean, obviously, heavy caveat needs to be added here that this whole myth of the Old West as a space of rough but fair justice obviously is like a kind of self-exculpating myth to cover up a, you know, widespread genocide on the part of the white American state as it establishes itself in all its hegemony. But, you know, A, Peckinpah, I think, is at least moderately sort of cognizant of that in terms of how he's deconstructing the Western. But this sense of like, oh no, things are only going to get more fucked from here. Or like the fact that Angel is being dragged behind a car, right? It's like he's not being dragged, you know, he's behind a horse, this guy's not on horseback, right?
Typical.
It's this, you know, I'm not sure if it's a Model T, but you know, it's that sort of, you know, just emerging commercial automobile. So it's a really interesting sequence for, on the one hand, just being like, okay, what is the most I can just riddle everyone in the scene with machine gun fire and like, how many explosives can I detonate? But at the same time,
well, you are talking as if the Irish audience got to see all the machine gun scene, which I'm afraid they didn't.
So that was, how does Pike die then?
I'm not quite sure. Kevin Rockett didn't have time to give a, you know, frame by frame account.
Did they have the kid shooting him?
I don't know. He said the machine gun scene was modified. I presume maybe it was shortened because it is quite long. Mm. There's a lot of shooting and there's a lot of killing. So maybe they just kind of compressed it in order to reduce the impact and thereby, you know, destroy Sam Peckinpah's artistic vision for the film. But anyway. But what really struck me about the mechanized gun thing, I was thinking about all of those films where, in particular, the British are going out like sort of being brave colonial heroes against foes who do not have the same weaponry. Now, for example, like Zulu, which is from 1964, you know, which is the Redcoats against the Zulus. And all of these films that are still like really powerful, like people love those films. Mm.
You get a dad on a sofa with a beer in front of that on UK TV Gold, and that dad has never dadded so hard.
Or aspirational dad also. There's a whole category of man that has yet to become dad. But is emotionally. But yeah, like what you say about Vietnam then really plays into it. You know, the firepower that the American state has in comparison to its adversaries in Vietnam. You know, the grotesque disparity in the armament race, and yet, you know, who loses, who wins, and who's good.
No, completely. Yeah, I mean, it in that sense, yeah, this is structurally very much a sort of Vietnam movie in that it stages that, you know, what becomes such a trope of it where, you know, a kind of technically superior force is outmaneuvered by a kind of indigenous population with far less technical support, but cunning and guile and whatever. And obviously, again, you know, with necessary caveats being made, the film is far from innocent of a noble savage figuration of the indigenous population. But, you know, they're very much depicted multiple times outsmarting even our hyper-competent heroes, and, you know, sneaking up on them and holding them at machete point. But they're always depicted as like they barely even have firearms. They just, you know, they have machetes. And yeah, there is this kind of iconography of like, yeah, this cutting edge instrument of mass slaughter versus, you know, this kind of quote unquote purer form of violence that is being wielded with an aim to liberating a people is a sort of undercurrent of the film, especially with that kind of culminating moment at the end where it's like, ah, you, the last gunslinger, come join us in, you know, a fight against the modern mechanized death-dealing state.
One of the things that really caught my eye about it was how it showed war as waged by the general in particular, who represents really flamboyant levels of violence and sadism. But, you know, when there's that really confusing part, that's one of the things I enjoyed about it, is that it doesn't really explain what's going on quite a lot of the time. So it's all quite chaotic. So the general is doing that kind of drive-by on a train raid, which they just land you in it as a viewer. You're just like, this is happening now. You're like, what is this to do? Why is this happening?
Yeah, and it presumably that's him going against another faction in the Revolutionary War.
Yes.
But it's made far from clear, and they get like, they come under mortar fire, I think.
Yeah, huge, like a lot of detonations, and it's a big set piece as well. You know, it goes all the way around the mountains and, you know, but it is still vastly confusing, which is quite brilliant because that's really what war is. But there's a woman standing on the back of the train singing a song during the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like a kind of an opera commentary.
Being like a bandolier as well. And there's a few sort of situated sequences of like song and kind of they process out of Angel's Village. They're sort of sung out as if they're already on a funeral procession for themselves.
And the women singing for the funerals, as you know, at the end, at the beginning and at the end, where the women are wearing black and they have crucifixes.
And in the midst of it as well. So it's something we haven't really touched on, but another example of the film's fairly gleeful misogyny of a sort. The whole thing with Angel is that the love of his life has gone off with the general and his people, and merrily, in the film's terms at least, like prostituted herself for this more affluent life. And so Angel and her have this sort of, they, you know, meet in the compound, and it's all very poignant and fraught, but then she goes off to the general and is like, you know, tonguing his ear basically, and Angel just stands up, shouts Puta, and shoots her in the heart. And again, the film's staging that as something that we're not exactly meant to be comfortable with, but that precipitates another funeral procession that moves through a scene of them having dinner and the sleazy, disgusting exorbitance of the general's compound. I mean, the scene that really clinches that, or I think one of the film's most kind of telling images that just sort of distills its attitude to this sort of militarism, is whenever the general gets his hands on the machine gun, and the German technical advisors are like, no, it needs a tripod, it needs a tripod. And he just like fires it from the hip and nearly kills everyone, but then relishes that he has this kind of uncontrollable thing and is just gleefully sort of letting it off. And it's, you know, it's, again, it's not uncomfortably cashing in on what it sort of figures as like the disgustingness of a kind of non-white masculinity, again, in ways that we might be wary of, but it's very effective in just making this guy look like an absolute monster, just like the, you know, piggish sort of entity with his, you know, phallic prosthesis, just merrily squeezing it off all over the shop.
He does make war look like a carnal fun experience, though. You know, everybody is having a good time.
Yes.
There's a lot of food. There's a lot of champagne, there's a lot of wine, there's a lot of sex. Mm. You know, it's a big party.
Yeah, there's something very carnivalesque about, and it's those weird moments where it like, it just goes a little too far.
Yeah, well, yes, of course, it's like, it's too much and it's gross. But also just like from the point of view of like the role of alcohol and drugs in combat and war, you know, like, all war is fought by people who are off their tits.
Yes.
Because it's a necessary condition of the experience. Mm. Like, people are on things, all sorts of things, usually three things at once to get themselves through it. So it's great. Like, it is attractive to a certain extent, but neither side are like the steely but completely unethical anti-heroes, you know, they're... Mm. they're going against their own country because they're Americans and they're helping these Mexican warlords to do God knows what. They don't care as long as they get paid. So,
yeah.
But they're also, they're a bit puritanical. You're like, they're just, you know, hanging out in the desert on their own. Doesn't seem like a lot of fun. Whereas the general has like a family party and like there are a lot of children also. The children are watching. It shows children watching them. Like the children move into shot at one point as Holden and the lads leave the compound. You know, they come out and they stand looking and you're like, what? Like it's very deliberate, the use of children like that in that compound.
Yeah. There are moments where it lags or where it sort of sags a little bit. But I, when it's on its game, I've not seen anything like this in terms of quite how it handles violence and what it means to stage violence. Mm. So in that sense, it feels like it's kind of connected with Peeping Tom as well, right? Like we're on a sort of, you know, self-interrogative voyeurism kick here in the 60s.
Yes, yeah, must be, because we didn't think that they would be related. In fact, we actually said, let's do a completely different film.
Little did we know.
Little did we know. So you would recommend it then?
Yeah, I think it's a caveated recommendation in the sense of it's worth knowing what you're going into here. So as a deconstructive interrogation of the Western and violence and its relationship to certain forms of, you know, state authority, etc. Really fascinating thing. If you don't find simulated violence troubling and can enjoy the technical intricacies of that, some of the way that the violence is staged is cinematographically like amazing. If you are disquieted by scantily clad non-white women repeatedly being called various derogatory slurs and then shot, might be hard to watch. And I'm laughing, you know, through kind of embarrassment, not like to be glib about that. It's so, and the film does that knowingly, but it, I'm sure listener patience with that might vary as whether it's sort of worth that. But as a work in the kind of the late style of the Western, like what happens to a genre when it's lived its felt normative salience and instead becomes a way of like interrogating the taken for granted ideological underpinnings of a certain kind of American mythologizing. Really interesting.
I have to say, for me, it kind of tasted of the boredom of Sunday afternoons. That for me, that's what Westerns were, the matinee on the telly and it's raining outside and there's nothing to do. And, you know, because it was two channel land. So there was basically, there was probably GAA on the other side. So sport or Westerns, they were your choices. So in that sense, I was never going to be won over. I think 100% there's too much baggage there for me to commit to Westerns. But I would definitely watch this over nearly any other Western I have seen recently. Okay, except for High Noon. I love High Noon because it's Gary Cooper. But yes, I would happily recommend this as a fascinating document. And like you say, sometimes a bit ick. But I think it's aware of a lot of the ick that it's dealing with a lot of the time. So I think you can kind of forgive
it. It means to provoke ick. And yeah, also I'm conscious that we're weirdly in the midst of a glut of interesting deconstructive queer cowboy performance art on the kind of particularly the London fringe theatre scene at the moment. And while queer this is not, if you're feeling the call of cowboys, this is there waiting for you.
Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.